Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
What's up, everybody? It's Sunday night once again. Welcome to Punch Drunk Critics Live. Travis is on. What, Travis looks like he's on air. I don't hear him, though. She'll be jumping on in just a second. We'll be talking tonight about Killing Them Softly, the new Brad Pitt movie that really kind of had me at hello, if I'm going to use that reference, just from the picture. Do you remember that first set picture that came out that I was like all man crushing on?
Yeah, the one where he's just coming around the corner with the shotgun?
Yeah. Yeah,
that
had me since then. So we'll talk about whether or not it lives up to that. And also, probably one of the newest, little-known cult horror favorites, The Collector, had its sequel hit theaters this weekend to a wider audience than the first one got completely, I think, in the collection. So we'll be talking about both those movies. And we'll also be talking about how Travis is refusing to throw the game that he's playing me in fantasy football so I can have a chance at the playoffs.
It's not supposed to be this close.
It's
actually, you're beating me by like 10 points right now. So, I mean, it's not supposed to be like this.
Yeah, you had me by like 20 points. I checked it an hour ago. I didn't look at it again. But, man, we haven't talked a lot of fantasy football, and we won't today either. But I said something to you the other day in a text. Man, I was doing so well, and then I went like a 3-game losing streak, and now I'm so far back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but at least you were in it. Like, I haven't been in it. In at least 4 or 5 weeks. I mean, my team has just been about as awful as one could be. So,
did you have injuries or something, or just people not performing?
Mostly, it was underperforming.
Wow.
I made some bad calls when it comes to who I held on to this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they have hurt me badly.
Well,
so I'm going to have some changes to make for next season.
That may be, but I think I can give myself the Bonehead of the Year award. Everybody was not thinking RG3 in the draft. I picked him up. I had him in both of my leagues. The other league, I honestly maybe check just to change my rosters. Not a league I care about or even care if I win. I kept RG3 in that one, and I dropped him in this one or traded him. And that is not turning out to do well for me because Drew Brees, not Philip Rivers, not who he was last year.
Philip Rivers has had a bad year. I thought you were going to say you were a bonehead because you kept in Brandon Stokely, who was out, and he did not play today.
He wasn't a game-time decision because he was probable when I looked
at
it.
He was questionable, I think, all day. And I meant to actually check the rosters again at about 3 o'clock, which is when the injury reports come in. The inactive active list, and I was busy, and I did not get a chance to do it. So I did not get a chance to see that you did not put in Brandon Stokely until it was too late.
I mean, that's a risk. If you look at my lineup, I'm looking at it right now. Of my entire team, I have 3 out, 4 questionable, and 5 probable. My whole thing is lit up with red. So,
yeah.
But we'll see how that goes and how the playoffs go. We'll get a chance to talk about that later on in the month. But
So.
We got The Collector. Were you a fan of The Collector? This is a movie I just saw literally 2 months ago. I didn't even know about it.
Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, I was actually one of the handful of people who thought The Collector was a pretty decent movie back in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed by Marcus Dunstan and written by Patrick Melton, two guys who basically ran the Saw franchise from about, I think, Saw 3 on up. And this one was actually designed to be a Saw prequel.
Right.
At one point, The Collector was. And if you saw The Collector, and you can see where that could possibly fit in if they had decided to do that. But I'm glad they didn't, because I think The Collector is better than Saw after 2 movies than they were, obviously. I mean, I think it's in a better position than
Definitely.
Saw was.
Yeah, I mean,
this doesn't mean these movies are great. I mean, I thought The Collector was a good movie, not a great movie. I think they actually take some solid steps into improving the franchise with The Collection. So we can talk about that.
I would agree with that, yeah, and we'll talk about it more in a minute here. But one of my biggest problems with the collector, and as people probably scoff at me because I'm a horror fan and I still have a problem with gaps in logic, but there was so many logic gaps in the first. It was a fun movie to watch, but this half of it just didn't make sense in reality. So that was a problem point. But I mean, we talk about the comparisons to Saw, and it's obvious, at least on the surface, where those are. But I really thought the collector was kind of even. Just one trap he did in the first movie was worse than everything in Saw except for the hypodermic needle pit. That's still
which one? Trap?
The very first one that Arkin gets in the first movie when he's pulling the wood boards out, and mm-hmm. the collector has rigged it so the two razor blades are pointing at like 45 degree angles outside, so you can slide your hand in, but then you have to skin yourself to get it back out. And
That was one of the things I liked about it, was that it had a lot of things like that. Like, it wasn't the traps weren't elaborate. They were like rather brutal. Common, but those are the worst ones. I mean, it's like rusty nails and broken glass, like shit like that. It disturbs me more than a giant axe cutting off somebody's head. Like, you know what I mean?
Because you need an engineering degree to do what Jigsaw did half the time. I mean, this guy, you know, give him a pack of rusty doornails in a half hour, and you got the traps. That's one of the main things that's scary about it. Plus, I got to give him the vote for one of the best masks we've seen in a while. There's something
that's very disturbing.
Yeah, it's very plain, but there's something in the eyes that just makes it very, very disturbing to look at.
I need to see the guy who's under the mask. And I don't want to see him under the mask in the movie. Like, I need to see him, like out on the street or something. Just so or a picture, a photo of him. I've never actually bothered to look up what he looks like. Yeah, the actor. Like, I just want to see him. Like, I don't want to see him. He should never have his mask off in the movie. No. Like, I don't ever want to see that. Just one of the reasons why they ruined Jigsaw and Saw was that they showed him. And to me, yeah, as much as I like the dude who's playing Jigsaw, That always takes some of the mystique out of it.
Yeah,
when you see the person and they're not what you had in mind for them. Yeah. But the collector's mask is very frightening, very simple, very clean, very 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 creepy in the way that it still manages to capture his kind of cold rage. I think is very good. He's very good at that.
Yeah, and the cold rage and the dead eyes. I mean, that's one of the things that this movie, both of them really gets a lot, is this guy, he's not, you see a lot of movies where psychotics are kind of pulled together. Like, they don't get upset, they don't get hostile, they're just calculating their moves, and this guy's a little bit different. Juan Fernandez is a guy that plays him. He's been in a whole bunch of stuff. Really kind of not what I thought he looked like, but he was in A Man Apart, was probably the biggest movie that I can think of that he was in.
Okay.
But
since we're already talking about it, let's talk about let's dig into the collection a little bit more. This film picks off basically where the last one left off, mm-hmm. Where Arkin, who's the kind of anti-hero from the last film, kind of a criminal who was forced into a position of playing a hero in the last film. He was just captured by the collector as one of his prizes. And in this one, the collector starts this movie off. I'll be honest. This movie had me after the first scene, okay? Mm-hmm. I was totally in with whatever they were going to do after the first scene. This really elaborate trap involving a bunch of people in a nightclub and a giant thresher or whatever you want to call it. It looked like a giant lawnmower attached to the top of the nightclub. And you can just kind of imagine what happens when that thing starts coming down on these people. It's horrific. It's just, I think at that point, you know, if you're going to be into this movie or not.
Yeah, no, if you're squeamish by the, if you stopped eating your popcorn by the first 10 minutes, then you're not going to make it the rest of the way. I thought the opening scene was perfect, and it knocked off all the checklists for the horror sequel right out the bat, and showed you how it was going to do it. You know, higher body count, more crazy stuff, and it hits it right out of the park there. I mean, and these kind of things, probably the worst example of it is Nightmare on Elm Street 2 when Freddy attacks the pool party. But one of the creepiest things and scariest things is attacking you when you where you know you're safe. And something like a nightclub, everybody, you know, we've all been to one, and they have their own dangers in the alleys outside. But you don't ever think there's going to be a huge mass murder with a giant lawnmower inside of a nightclub. And though we probably still don't think that's going to happen, it's more disturbing to see somewhat safe places turned not safe.
I'd like to know how he was able to set something like that up, but I guess that's a question for another day. But what I really liked about that scene is that it established that this one's not going to be like the Collector was. Mm-hmm. I mean, within 5 minutes, I knew that this was not going to be like the Collector was. The Collector, as much as I enjoyed it, was really dark and very atmospheric, very moody, and it really just kind of played things straight. This one, I think with that first scene, it said, okay, we're going to have a little bit more fun in this one,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to be a little bit more gruesome and just kind of wing it a little bit, you know? And I think that's what they did. This one's a lot looser. It's still extremely gory, but this one is a lot more like, this one felt like Aliens to me a little bit. I mean, it has Arkin who escapes from the nightclub, escapes from the Collector's clutches when he's distracted by a girl named Elena, who's the daughter of a rich man, and the Collector takes her instead. And after Arkin gets away, he's approached by Elena's father, who basically forces him to accompany a group of mercenaries to break into the Collector's stronghold and retrieve his daughter. So what you have is sort of like an Alien scenario where you're kind of you're walking on enemy turf.
Yeah, that's actually a very apt comparison because it's almost the same as keeping the entire universe but changing the genre just slightly.
Right.
But even when you put it down on the plot like that, it almost sounds exactly like Aliens. But yeah, I thought it was a very good way to do it, and it still kept everything in there. I was very happy with this movie. I was what I was saying earlier about the plot holes. You had mentioned how he set that trap up. That was kind of one of my issues with the first movie, but an issue I got over because it was fun enough. Where, you know, in The Collector, Arkin walks into the house that he's breaking into, and there's nothing around. And then 10 seconds later, there's traps laid everywhere. And you know, I can forgive that if it's fun enough and there's enough else going on. I can forget about that. It doesn't seem like some people could, but I definitely can.
Right. Well, they get into this place, and basically what you have is a scenario where they're all just trying to survive, avoiding the Collector's traps along the way. And I love the design of his little headquarters. The inside of it's got all sorts of trophies to the things he's killed, the things he's collected. Mm-hmm. It's very, very macabre and very kind of chilling, the things he has stashed away there. But I wish they could have explained a little bit more how he was able to get basically like an army full of zombies almost. I mean, like these drugged out people who are just kind of stashed away in his house, and they're like enraged. And he basically just unleashes them on the mercenaries at one point. And I was like, really? I was like, that seems, I mean, like, I know they were trying to up the ante and stuff, but that seemed like a touch overboard. I was like, yeah, I don't know about that one.
that definitely, you know, I mean, they have, when making movies like this, and they're either in the editing room or looking at the storyboards before they shoot, this seems like one of those parts that somebody's like, I guess it sounds cool, but we don't need it. I wanted to ask you about the kind of the explanation of who he is, if you want to say it that way.
Uh-huh.
Now, we talked about in the first movie, or I don't know if we said it or not, but in the first movie, there's really no explanation. I mean, it starts off with showing how Collector does things, and then it ends kind of just as unceremoniously showing that he's still out there. And it doesn't really say why he's doing what he does, like what's the end game, like what does he have a moral high ground that he saw? Well, they showed at least a little bit about his background. I mean, it was very kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre-ish with his family tree. But did you think it would be better if they kept it like completely not anonymous? What am I saying? Completely mysterious.
I'd rather they stay mysterious for at least a while longer. One of the things that's really screwed up Saw is that they realized how popular the Jigsaw was, so the natural thing to do from that point is to kind of turn him from less of a villain into an anti-hero, and that really lessened the character for the rest of the franchise for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things. It's the Hannibal Lecter syndrome. They did that to Hannibal Lecter too. You know, he became popular. So what'd they do with the movie Hannibal? They turned him into an anti-hero. You know, they had him attacking rich people and bad guys. You know, and the character doesn't have the same effectiveness.
Yeah.
And I don't want to see them do that with this franchise, because I think the Collector's a very unique original villain at this point. Because we don't know that much about him, except that he's really disturbed and twisted and obsessed with death. That's really about all we know at this point, you know. Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say the setup is great to keep that kind of mystery. That's why I wanted to ask this, because I was kind of let down by the fact that we knew too much by the end of this movie. I even thought. You know, if anybody hasn't seen it, we probably said this three times already, but basically his MO is he goes into a house, kills everybody in it, and the last person there he puts in a red trunk. And that's pretty much all you know. And that's like, why is there some significance to it? It's just set up for mystery to make a movie that maybe, if everything was explained, wouldn't be deep at all or have any layers, but it kind of gives it that extra bit. And I don't know if they screwed that up or not by giving away too much. I still had fun with the movie, though.
Yeah, and I want to say that I don't really like Josh Stewart that much as Arkin. I think he's sort of sleepy-eyed and doesn't really have a whole lot of charisma as a leading guy. But Emma Fitzpatrick as Elena, as soon as she was on screen, I said to myself, since there was nobody else there, basically, practically, not many people attended this screening, I said that the franchise needs to focus on her.
Yeah,
and I could see that I think that Dunstan and Melton kind of realized that too. She's really fantastic here, and I'm not just saying that because she's sexy as hell, although she certainly is. She had a great strength and personality, and her character was really smart. She wasn't your typical damsel in distress for these kinds of movies. So I thought she was fantastic and had a lot more presence than Josh Stewart did. I'd much rather see the movies center their attention around her than on him.
Yeah, Josh Stewart, it really seems like they should have pulled an El Mariachi with him, and that's, you know, he. I'm sure he was the good actor for the part when it was a small indie movie that they didn't think he was going to see, but now that it has a chance, you know, it actually did well, has a chance. I mean, as heartless as it might sound in the poor guy's career, I really think they should have thought about recasting that, you know, with not even a bigger name, but just a better actor.
I thought at one point they were going to have him end up being the Collector. Somehow, mm-hmm. or, you know, pulling the switcheroo. And they still might do that. I mean, that's usually how these things tend to go when you run out of ideas. Mm-hmm. That's where these things go. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did.
You know, I'd like to see is instead of having somebody affected by the person take over, just do something that nobody's ever done that actually happens in real life, and that's just have some random psycho become a copycat.
Right.
They do that sometimes, but it's always some connection to the original person. That would almost make it crazier just to know that people are out there that actually do that. So
yeah. Have you actually gone and looked up pictures of Emma Fitzpatrick, like just regular? You know,
am I putting safe search on or off? No, no,
safe,
I haven't.
Safe search is always off, my friend. she's pretty amazing. And I'm curious to see where she goes, because I don't know if this is her first role, but it's one of them. It's very early for her in her career. Yeah, so I'm curious to see where she goes after this. I'm sure she'll be back for the next Collector movie, if there is one. We'll talk about how this did at the box office in a few minutes. But I want to see what she does next.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because I was just watching Trading Places like a couple hours ago, and my wife and I were talking about how Jamie Lee Curtis always looks great with short hair. And Emma Fitzpatrick apparently cut from that same cloth, because there's a couple pictures of her with longer hair, and she doesn't look anywhere near as stunning as she does with the short hair.
Well, shut me up. She was in The Social Network.
who was she in that?
As a character named Sharon, who I don't remember. But
probably like one of the people sitting at the table in the restaurant.
I know. She's probably just some random chick in the movie, but I don't remember it. But
what would you give this movie on the Gutenberg scale, and what would you give Collector as well?
Just so she was in End Time also. Huh. Okay, I need to rewatch that one again then. I gave this a 3.5 out of 5. I did enjoy it. I think it ups to ante. It changes the tone. Goes from being dark and moody to a little bit more actiony, a little bit more fast paced. And I think that's a good move to kind of separate it from other horror movies. So I gave it 3.5 out of 5.
I think it's a 3 out of 5 for me. It's they did something very well, and that's they were able to up it without making it completely silly and still scary, which is usually what happens. Most of the time when you have an indie horror that becomes cult or whatever, when they try to bring it to main screen, they're like, okay, what do we do right? Okay, let's turn that to 100. And right. It ends up looking ridiculous. But I thought they did a great job. I mean, I think they maybe laid too much of the story out, like went too far in the plot in the one movie. And I think there were still kind of some logic situations that bugged me a little bit. It seemed a little bit lazy. But other than that, I thought it was a completely enjoyable movie. I think people will be pleasantly surprised with this and The Collector. So definitely check that out.
We have somebody on hold here. Let me see who this is before we jump into Killing Them Softly.
Wait.
Hello, who's this? Hello?
You're on the air.
They might have just been listening in.
If you're trying to call in and talk to us, maybe you're having trouble with your phone, just jump on the chat window and let us know if you guys want to talk, and we will put you on air right away.
Yep. All right, let's talk about Killing Them Softly. We probably should have started with this movie, so this is the big one of the week. But it doesn't matter. We got to start caught up talking about The Collection. It's fine. There's been a lot of buzz surrounding Killing Them Softly ever since it started debuting at festivals, and part of the reason is that it's coming from Andrew Dominik, who's a very stylish director, reteaming with Brad Pitt, who he worked with on The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, a movie that I thought was more ambitious than good. And part of the reason why I didn't like it so much was Brad Pitt. I didn't feel like he had the charisma to play Jesse James in a movie that was really about the celebrity culture even back then. I didn't think he had the personality for it, which is the total opposite of what he has here. He's amazing in this movie, actually. And he dominates it from the moment he steps on screen to that Johnny Cash song. I can't remember which song it was.
We have to do a list at some point to count how many
When the Man Comes Around.
How many movies and trailers have used Johnny Cash songs in the last 10 years? Because it's like if you want a good Quentin Tarantino did it with Django. They did it with Killing Them Softly. It's like there's so many movies that use Johnny. His estate must be huge just from licensing.
Yeah. Well, from the moment he walks onto the screen with When the Man Came to Town from Johnny Cash, he just had totally dominant system. The movie basically is it sounds like your average everyday crime movie, but it really isn't. And basically what it has to do with is a pair of really stupid criminals played by the awesome Scoot McNairy and Ben Mendelsohn from Animal Kingdom robbing a mob-protected poker game. And Brad Pitt plays Jackie Kogan, who is a mob enforcer who's brought in to find out who robbed the joint and basically take him out. But as simple as that sounds, nothing about this movie is really all that simple or textbook. And I've said that I think that this movie does for crime movies what The Sopranos did for the crime on TV. It makes you look at these characters in a totally different way. It makes you look at them as people and kind of changes your perception of the entire genre. But basically what happens is all of these people are in some way affected by the economic crisis. The movie takes place in 2008. During the worst parts of the economic downturn. And throughout the movie, all you hear is a lot of big rhetoric and broken promises from Barack Obama, John McCain, George Bush, all these things in the background. Apparently, everybody who works for the mob listens to C-SPAN and political talk radio when they're just hanging out. But it actually provides a very poignant backdrop for the entire movie. The things that happen in it line up quite well. I mean, you have George Bush making some big promise about something that goes on in the economy, and then you have some idiot letting Jackie Kogan down at the same time. All this stuff goes together perfectly. The corporate nature of our economic system has apparently infected the criminal element now. You got middle managers played by Richard Jenkins and a bunch of corporate stooges in there who don't seem to know how to handle anything for themselves. It's a very interesting dynamic working in this movie that I found really interesting. That's not to say there's not a lot of violence in it, because there is, but it's clearly secondary to everything else that's going on.
Oh yeah, and they did a lot of things in this movie. I mean, I'll start by saying I thought the movie was just as it did not let me down with the picture from the first. It delivers exactly what that picture is. It's a little bit noir. Love that. It's a lot violent. Love that, and it's smart at the same time. It's not. And not smart by the use of 14-syllable words. Smart by, you know, it sounds genuine, but it still gets points across. It's just the writing was great, I thought too. I wasn't sure. I'll admit, I was very slow on the uptake with the political background on the TV. But I started to realize that they just did one of the things I hate, but in a way I like. And that's kind of, you know, I always say I hate when filmmakers hit you over the head with something that they're trying to tell you. Well. Mm-hmm. Putting that in the background was kind of like almost like a subconscious type subliminal. I mean, way to say, hey, look, you know, this works on the same level as everything else, as the politicians. As when bad things happen, they happen everywhere. These people are working crime, but they work the same way. And I thought the best thing that they did well was Brad Pitt is a badass. Period. End of story. But they try. A lot of times when they give the bad guy or anti-hero morals. Or like kind of a heart. That's a weird way to put it, but like his whole thing about he doesn't like people to suffer. He just likes doing the job. That's something that I've seen a lot of times go very badly or very weirdly. I thought they handled it perfectly, where you never thought he was any softer than he looked when you first saw him. But you know, he's just like, hey, what's the point of doing it? It's a very, you know, matter of fact way of, you know, I do this job, but I'm not a complete psychopath.
Right, and that's one of the things I liked about him. But the thing that really made him stand out amongst everybody else, and I think I was talking about this with Tim Gordon. We were wondering why he stands out amongst everybody else in this movie. It's not just because he's Brad Pitt. It's because Jackie Coogan is the guy who kind of cuts through all the bullshit. Everybody else is either scamming on somebody or is totally clueless about what's going on. And Jackie's just sort of the guy who's like, you know, let's just get this shit done and get it over with. And stop fucking with me and stop fucking around about money. He's kind of old school in that way, which is ironic because, you know, everybody else around him was probably old school at one time too, but the economic crisis has just turned them into either idiots or desperate.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because he has some of the same issues they have financially. At least it sounded like that to me. But he hasn't let it drive him up a wall. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I like how he is portrayed as the solution to bureaucracy. I mean, you get the complete level of bureaucracy that you wouldn't. I mean, everybody's watched Sopranos know that there's hierarchical organization in the mafia and everything like that. But you don't really think about it like you would think, your local MVA working or something like that, where there's a lot of bureaucratic red tape. And it's not labeled that way, but you can see it's there.
Yeah. And the corporatization of the mafia is what happens. I mean, you have people. They're pinching pennies over, you know, over the cost of a contract hit.
Right.
And the looks on Brad Pitt's face while this stuff is going on is just hilarious.
Yeah, well, that's one thing Brad Pitt can always bring is a little bit of relatable humor type deal. I almost want to say it's on a 100 times better level than Jim Halpert on The Office, like looking at the camera once in a while, like giving you that really type stuff. He does, like, you saw it in Moneyball, you see it in this, you see it in most of the stuff he does. But I thought he played the perfect contrast to that bureaucracy, like the person that we all think we want to be when we actually take a step back and look at the bureaucratic way of the world, where it's like, why are we doing A, C, and E when we can just go right to B right in the middle and just take care of it? And that's kind of who he is. He doesn't understand all the different levels of why do we have to get this approved and my TPS reports turned in before we do everything else. And I like that.
Yeah, no, I love that element of it too. In terms of the violence, the way this Dominic handles stuff like this has always been interesting. And it was like this in Assassination of Jesse James also. Mm-hmm. He loves using the slow motion. The violence in this movie is very stylized sometimes. In one particular scene where a character is being taken out in a drive-by, it's extremely stylized. And to me, that kind of makes the violence a little bit more brutal the way it's done. But also because he doesn't stick to one particular style. Sometimes it's very flashy when somebody gets messed up in this movie, but other times it's extremely straightforward and very blunt. And I think not being able to predict how the violence is going to happen makes it more effective. It's not like the movie's it's not wall-to-wall violence. This is a very talky, conversational movie. But when the violence happens, it happens for a reason, and it happens quick, and it happens really bad. So, yeah. And I love movies like that. There's nothing gratuitous about the violence in this movie.
No, yeah, it's really kind of it makes everything a little bit more unsettling because you know that's how it happens. Like, remember when Casino Royale came out? Everybody was clamoring over the opening scene where he didn't just punch the guy once and he died. It was hard for him to get. Well, right. The way that this comes up is kind of the way that I would imagine this shit happens in real life, where there is a bunch of talking and there's all this, and then when everything's finally decided, bing, bang, boom, done, quick, and it's, like you said, bloody.
Unless you hire James Gandolfini to do it, and then it never gets done.
I cannot get his mouth breathing, ever.
No, he always sounds like he's breathing through a styrofoam cup.
Yeah.
But yeah, James Gandolfini's character is hilarious in this movie. He's not at all like Tony Soprano, unless it's Tony Soprano 30 years later and he's extremely lazy. He's basically just here as sort of a symbolic figure, a warning sign. It's basically all he's there for. But he has some of the best scenes of the movie opposite Brad Pitt. And he's basically playing a hitman who's brought in to take care of one of the guys because Pitt can't do both. And he's become addicted to alcohol and strippers and things like that. And he's just not going to get out there and do the job he was paid for. They have some great conversations, but all the conversations in this movie are really well written, smart, fast, and hilarious.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to call it chemistry or partnership, that and the differences in the way they want to do their jobs and the care that where each one places the care they want to take with what they're doing really makes their scenes either interesting. Gandolfini, I always don't mind him, but I never really like him. I don't know what it is. Like in The Sopranos, I he was awesome. I mean, nobody can argue that. The later seasons, not so much, but he always seems kind of out of place. Even in a movie like this, it is pretty much his typecast standard movie. He just never really seems like – he has the look to be there, but he just never seems like he's there for me. I think that's just a me thing where I have a problem with him personally. But not personally, but you know what I mean. But it's just never 100% right. So, but that being said, I thought that he wasn't distracting or anything like that.
Yeah. Overall, I gave this a 4 out of 5. I really think this is fantastic. One of the things that I did have a problem with, which is why the score isn't higher, is I think Dominic needs to have somebody rein him in on occasion. I do feel like he went overboard with the allegory a little bit. I think he made his point about the economic crisis fairly early on in the movie. I didn't feel like it needed to be a constant reference. I know some people disagree with me, but I didn't feel like it needed to be hammered home quite the way it was. But other than that, I enjoyed pretty much every moment of this. So 4 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, I guess a 4.5 out of 5 for me, because this is probably one of 3 movies I can think of this year that not only lived up to my expectations for, but surpassed them. And, I can certainly see what you're saying about the political rhetoric. But for me, it still seemed background to a lot of things. So that didn't get to me too much. There's really not too much that I can say I didn't like about this movie, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, it had the violence, it had the action, it had the humor, and then that, you know, the look of the movie itself, I don't think I mentioned that, is if you remember us talking about Spider-Man, that The Amazing Spider-Man came out over the summer, the wet and dirty look of that town, this kind of has the same feel where it always looks like it's drizzling or just rained, and it fits perfectly with the universe here. So I thought he did a great job with it, and I would recommend it to everybody.
All right. Well,
how did these movies do at the box office? That's the question.
All right. So what's your final score for that one?
4.5.
Okay, sweet. So 4 out of 5 and 4.5 out of 5. I think we both recommend both movies, for different reasons and in different ways. But yeah, I think we both recommend both movies.
Most certainly.
All right. Let's jump into the box office. This is an interesting week. Following up from last week, the Thanksgiving weekend, which was just incredible, It's almost always that the week after that is terrible, and that was the case here. Number one for the third week in a row was The Twilight Saga: Breaking Dawn, which now is up to $254 million and over $700 million worldwide. So yeah, it's not going anywhere. I don't care what anybody says.
Crazy.
And, yeah. Number two is Skyfall, which is up to $246 million. Number three is Lincoln, which is inching its way to $100 million. It's now at 83.7. The thing that was interesting about that is that it's still only at 2018 theaters.
Really?
So yeah, no, it's still at just over 2,000 theaters. So it's doing extremely well. And I'm curious to know why they're doing it that way. But the only thing I can think of is that they're going to hit some of those territories they haven't been as we get closer to Oscar nominations.
Yeah,
I think that's what they're going
to
do.
I would really love to sit in on one of these distribution meetings where they decide this stuff, because there's so much money that's put into marketing and, you know, all that stuff where the cast does the rounds on Regis and Kelly or whoever the hell is doing that show now, and things like, you know, The Late Show and everything. And so much is done in that, but as soon as that week's over, the next circus is coming into town. I mean, and it's kind of old news. So I would love to see what they were talking about. They must have had a hell of a lot of faith in the word of mouth of this movie that it would stay that hot for that long, and people are still talking about it. I know this is one of the movies
oh, yeah.
a long time that people say they're still going to go see.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of positive talk about this movie. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. The last screening I went to, I can't remember what movie it was. It might have been Killing Them Softly. Not sure. Oh no, it was Promised Land. There was a special screening of Lincoln just a couple doors down, mm-hmm. and it was for politicians and Congress people and Senate people. And I was like, I told one of the Allied reps, like, I'm just going to walk over here to this room and see if I can talk to some Congress people for a minute. I got some gripes. and there were a couple of Secret Service dudes blocking the door, so I wasn't going to get very far. But that would have been fun. I could have told them I had a pothole in my area that I needed fixing. But anyway, but yeah, there's a lot of good talk about Lincoln. It's going to be hanging around for a long time. I think we're going to see this one. I think the box office alone is going to put it into the Oscar race. Even if the like critical reviews have only been, you know, maybe above average, I don't think this movie has been reviewed quite as well as a lot of others.
Mm-hmm.
But the popular support it seems to be gaining is going to go a long way.
Yeah, I'm still kind of surprised by that it's got as many negative reviews as it's got. Not negative, I don't want to say that, but not glaring, not 5-star reviews. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean I didn't give it that good of a grade either. So, I mean, I think I gave it a 3 out of 5. I was not all that hot on this movie. So,
mm-hmm.
All right. So next up is The Rise of the Guardians, which is up to $49 million. And behind that is Life of Pi, which is at 48.3. Last week, these movies were in two totally different positions. Now, mm-hmm. their box office has been similar both weeks. But it seemed like last week, Rise of the Guardians had a lot of momentum. And Life of Pi was like, okay, it did well. You know, did pretty well. This week, it's total opposite. Now, it's like Life of Pi is the movie that is overperforming, I think. And I think it's because it has a lot of Oscar attention now. It seems to be on the upswing, whereas Rise of the Guardians, after 2 weeks, kind of seems like it's running out of steam. So it's and maybe it's because it was also a very expensive movie, Rise of the Guardians, and you know, and animated movies tend to do better than a movie like Life of Pi, which you know a lot of people won't go see because they expect it to be either preachy or emotionless because of the technical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't proven to be the case with Life of Pi. People have actually felt differently about that. Whereas Rise of the Guardians, I think people are like, you know, animated movie, been there, done that.
Yeah, I just real quick, because I hadn't had a chance to see Rise of the Guardians last week when we talked about it, and we got a screener for it this past week. I thought it was you were right on point. It's an awesome movie. I was really surprised.
It is. It's a great movie. I mean, I really did enjoy it a lot. Just like I enjoyed Life of Pi, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both those movies have different momentum going right now. Number six is Wreck-It Ralph, which is up to $158 million. Number seven is Killing Them Softly, which is the movie we just talked about. And this one took a gunshot wound to the chest. $7 million is how it opened. The worst opening for a Brad Pitt movie in nearly 20 years, 18 years, I think is the exact number. But worse than that, it got an F cinema score.
Really?
Which means that the few people who did go to see it hated it. I guess they really did. They really expected your more conventional, crime movie, and obviously they were very disappointed in a movie that's kind of atypical. F. You don't see a lot of Fs.
No, that kind of shocks me actually.
Yeah, you do not see a lot of Fs. Alex Cross didn't get an F. I mean,
Drive, which I know everybody loved Drive, but that's the one that I can compare it to how people would have felt seeing that movie. And you know, I love Killing Them Softly. I didn't like Drive so much, but even Drive had good scores.
Right, Drive got like a C, but yeah. not almost nothing gets an F. So the fact that this one did with a star like Brad Pitt and the kind of critical reception it's had, I think it's just amazing. That's really striking to me.
That is, yeah. I almost want to say somebody mixed up the scores because that doesn't even seem like it could be possible. But
well, if there were any other scores, but CinemaScore didn't track the collection this week, so the only movie they did was Killing Them Softly, so they don't have anything to get it mixed up with.
Oh,
so it's just a flat out F for this movie. And I'm trying to think what was the last movie I saw get an F CinemaScore, and I honestly don't even know. It certainly hasn't been recently. It has to have been 6 months or more ago that it could have happened because I don't remember it at all. It's crazy.
I'm just in shock. An F is crazy. Right? I mean, you know, even if it was a horrible movie, which it's not, Brad Pitt would give you at least a D. You know, that's crazy to me.
I wonder if that's Tim Gordon. That's not him, is it? Who's sitting there on the line? He was actually just in our chat room and then logged out. Let me see something here. Who's this?
You guys are idiots. I've been sitting here listening to you for 40 minutes. Really?
No.
Oh, no.
Look, I'll mute your mic. We went to you 20 minutes ago and said, Who's this?
All right. Here we go again. All right. I'm not going to say a word. I'm just going to continue and listen and be, like, really upset. And John Nolan, of all people, you were with him. So I always beat Travis up. You got to get some, too.
did you not like Killing Him Softly?
I'm, like, seven topics behind, man. I came in for the collection, didn't get a chance to talk about that. I miss Killing Him Softly. I miss Fine Emma Fitzgerald. I missed everything.
You wanted to talk about Killing Him Softly. I mean, the collection, a movie I know damn well you didn't see. And you but if you want to talk about Emma Fitzpatrick, we could certainly do that.
No, man. No, actually,
hey, where are the white women at?
I almost feel bad for coming on because I was listening to the two of you. You guys sound really well. Anybody who can break down a horror movie the way that you guys did, I was like sitting here going, wow, that's skill.
Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim.
Why don't you give us your quick thoughts on, I mean, did you just hear what we were talking about with Killing Them Softly and the box office and the cinema score for it?
All right. I don't think you understand. I said I've been listening for 40 minutes. I've heard everything you guys have said. It's not what you just talked about.
Then what's your opinion then about that? Because we're both here kind of flabbergasted that, I can understand the audience going to the movie and being disappointed that it's not, you know, just all shoot 'em up. But an F is really incredible for a cinema score. It just does not happen that often. And to have it happen for a movie like this, I think it's just crazy. So what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, it's, you know, many a times that we watch movies and review movies, we think that the public... The public doesn't get it right. I think right. I'm doing that. I don't think that's you doing that. Am I correct?
No, that was me actually that time. That was an accident. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought that was me. But anyway, I was going to say that I think that at times, and it happens a lot, where we review movies that we feel one way about, and the public, you know, no matter if we say, hey, don't go, they'll still go, or if we tell them, in this case, to go, and they don't go. I mean, no disrespect to anybody that's listening that's an audience member, but the audience is sheep. And I always tell people all the time, I said, you know, if it comes down between John Nolan, who I know is going to see anywhere between 200 to 400 movies a year, and like the common dude on the street who's only going to see like 60 movies a year, right, I'm going to trust what John is going to tell me more so than somebody else, even if I realize that you kind of agreement with me on some issues, because I just know that John's range is going to be so much more than the average person. Like you just said, it got an F. I really don't understand that unless, as you said, Travis, they went in looking for one thing and they got something else. But I love this movie. I mean, you and I sat next to each other. I was like, wow. I mean, but sometimes, you know, people aren't in a mood for a certain movie. Maybe this is a movie that if you would have released it, say, a month earlier, a month and a half earlier, mid-October, early November, you might have got a different reaction. But I'm with John. How does any movie with Brad Pitt get an F?
Well, really? I mean, the only thing I can think of is that, you know, when we talk about movies, review movies, even if we hate it, we know we have to be somewhat objective and say, okay, I hated it, but it wasn't a 0 out of 5. You know, we have to be, you know, responsible with what we say. But, you know, an audience member that comes out, if they don't like something and they just feel they might not give it a chance, it's like, oh, it sucked to F. You know, kind of like when you're filling out a form somewhere and like, how was our service on 1 to 5? You always do the best, unless it was bad, and then you always do worse. So that's the only thing I can think of that could possibly be behind that, is that everybody just was really mad that day.
Well, I mean, I don't think that movie deserves an F, and it is rather shocking that they positioned it for it to come out and be released as the major movie of the weekend, and nobody saw it. It's like, wow, damn, Brad.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. For reference, Alex Cross got an A, Fun Size got a B, and something else really terrible got an A recently, and I can't think what it was.
That's kind of skewed, though, because, I mean, any Tyler Perry
here comes the boom.
Every Tyler Perry movie.
Here Comes the Boom got an A. I mean, so, I mean, I mean, yeah, so, I mean, audiences, you know, whatever, what can you do? They have their opinions. All right, let's finish up this top 10 here. All right, go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead. I just wanted to say one thing before you kicked me off the phone tonight, that I wanted to start to bang the drum for a performance that I really fell in love with last night when I watched The Untouchables. And, you know, I'm just pushing the Omar Sy candidacy big time. For any and everybody that's out there listening, specifically the two of you, for reasons that you understand. I have no stake in the game. I just think it was a great performance, man.
I agree with you. I saw The Untouchables at the at Film Fest DC back in April, I think. And Omar Sy, his performance in that movie really, really struck me. And I understood why it was such a popular movie. I mean, it was named a cultural phenomenon in France for that year when it came out, a cultural touchstone. I mean, they fell in love with it, and I kind of fell in love with it, too. And I understand that people have issues with some of the race aspects of the movie. But that's French humor. I mean, they don't have the same hang-ups we do. They don't see things the same way we do. So I was able to look past that and get beyond it. But Omar Sy, I think he's fantastic. And I thought he could have – I think he could do the role here for the remake if they wanted to. I think he's good enough that he could do that here and become a big star here in America. But it sounds like they're looking at Chris Tucker for it. But, I mean, I would have preferred it had been Omar Sy for the remake as well.
I'm really disgusted that you know, American audiences either are not going out to see these movies, don't want to read subtitles. I just think it's like, why do we have to keep remaking movies and screwing them up that are made well the first time? You know, didn't Girl with the Dragon Tattoo teach us anything?
Well, that's right. That's a very American way about things. If we see a foreign movie, like, oh, that's a great French movie, but it's still a French movie. You know what would make it better? Being an American movie. And even if it's the same thing shot for shot, and it does, it loses. I mean, I'm not being anti-American by any way by saying, but that's kind of like the feeling I get from the public on a lot of the stuff. And I was kind of that way with subtitled movies. I could thank Travis for getting me out of that with my Gateway subtitle movie, B-13. And like once you get over the hump of reading them and you don't notice you're doing it 5 minutes later, but people can't give it a chance. So yeah, that's this remake stuff is an issue, but it'll never go away, especially because now you can make more money when you do it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
But go ahead, Travis.
Exactly.
I'm just listening.
The remake for that is probably going to be Colin Firth and Chris Tucker, which I think is a funny combination.
I'm so bitter right now because I took Untouchables off my list when This Is 40 came in for Saturday night watches, and I watched This Is 40 instead, and that was a horrible decision of mine, apparently.
Well, I just watched This Is 40 yesterday. I'm not going to say it was horrible. I'm not going to say go that far. But I would say that I prefer the Untouchables to that. So, anyway, finishing up the top 10, Red Dawn is at number 8 at $31 million. 9 is Flight, which is at $81 million. So that one's doing really well. Another hit for Denzel Washington. And number 10 is The Collection, which opened at $3.4 million. Now, one of the things that was interesting about this is that the 2009 version of the 2009 film, The Collector, opened at 1,300 theaters and had $3.5 million. This one opened at almost exactly the same number of theaters and had almost the exact same number of dollars. So
I did not know it opened that big.
Yeah. So I mean, so obviously it didn't really expand much in the way of fan bases over the last 3 years. I still find it as something of a cult hit, but I don't know if people are going to run out necessarily to see The Collection or The Collector or anything. So.
Yeah. You know, I've said 100 times already because I'm pretty repetitive, we're getting all our Oscar movies in. I watched Flight again the other day. Man, that especially right before the last season movie, I won't spoil anything, but that is one of those movies that's just like you know what's going to happen, but you still are like hoping beyond hope that there's some kind of alternate ending that you can watch something different. And that's an emotional movie to watch.
I'm glad you think so. I'm glad you think so.
What?
I mean, we talked about Flight. This is another one that I was not totally on board for.
Tim's not a fan either, so I'm just like, hey.
Thanks. And that's not a knock on Denzel Washington, who I think is great. It was all script for me. It just did not work. Script and tone. Tone, I blame on Zemeckis.
Tone, I can see. I just thought there was, a lot of like strong like. Anytime you see somebody struggling with something, it's crazy, and it's just when you see that train wreck coming and it's gonna happen. I don't know. It got me.
Okay, that's cool. All right. So let's talk about DVDs that are coming out on Tuesday because this is a huge week. Because we're in December and they want you to buy stuff for stocking stuffers.
Yes.
So the DVDs this week are huge.
Yeah.
Starting obviously with The Dark Knight Rises, which is coming out on Tuesday. The end of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. I know there's a lot of people that were disappointed in it. I was not one of those people. I thought it lived up to expectations. Expectations that I thought were way too lofty for a lot of people, and I thought it met those. People wanted it to be The Dark Knight, and that's just not fair. But also coming out this week is the Dark Knight trilogy, if you want to get all three together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's obviously going to be the top buy for this week.
Oh, no doubt. And,
well,
and
just give me the Dark Knight, man. I got the other two already.
One thing the Batman series has done really well, at least I don't know if they did it for Begins, because I honestly don't know, but in The Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises now, they have this cool collector's pack that comes with a legit little prop. It's not some little flippy paper thing. Like Dark Knight, I got a cowl.
The cowl? Yeah,
I
the cowl.
I still have on my desk right here. And now you have the broken cowl. I'm sure they probably have another one because they had a joke for the other time. But Beast of the Southern Wild, this is something I wanted to bring up when you guys were talking earlier about the Untouchables getting Oscar nominations. Like, Dwight Henry still blows me away, especially that he wasn't an actor beforehand. I mean, this movie, I think we can all agree was, I'm not going to get blown out of the room if I say it was amazing, right?
No, it was amazing. I want to watch it again. I mean, I haven't seen it since this summer. I want to watch it one more time before we do our WAFCA and and whatever that awards is that Tim Gordon runs. I want to do that in the end. Before I do any of those.
That would be the
Black Reel. The Black Reel Awards, of course. But yeah, I really want to see it one more time and get a final judgment on Kuvenzhané Wallace. I'm pretty sure I butchered her name, I think.
Let me do it.
Kuvenzhané Wallace.
Thank you. I really want to get a gauge on her one more time because I know there's a lot of people who think she should be nominated for Best Actress, and I've been against that because I just don't like child actors getting nominated that early because they tend to come and go. But I really want to see it one more time and get another look at it.
Yeah, she's incredibly effective in the role. I think child actors get some like nomination words sometimes just because they're that much, you know, their adorability, it really plays the emotions. Like, I can't watch the damn movie without tearing up when she starts going on. And it's where a lot of people get to, I guess. But, you know, Best Actor Academy Award is pretty huge.
I want Dwight Henry for Best Supporting.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's not. But I think he deserves to be. And I find the supporting category to be a little thin this year. And I think that he should be in that, at least in the running to be nominated. So I mean, but we'll see.
Nah, you got a better shot with Kuvenzhané Wallace getting a nomination than Dwight Henry.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, by the way, I just went online and looked at the price for the Dark Knight trilogy.
Uh-huh.
I may have to buy me that tonight.
Well, you should go to punchdrunkcritics.com and click on the shop button.
Wait, hold on a second. How much is it in the shop?
You really should do that, Tim, because right now you can get the Dark Knight Rises trilogy for 43% off, $29.96, $30, three Blu-rays.
Bam.
Go to punchdrunkcritics.com, click on shop at punchdrunkcritics in the upper right-hand corner. I would say it's the best deal on the internet.
How much? He said, how much off can I get?
43%. You save $23.
Wow. That's a great deal. I'm going to punchdrunkcritics.com right now.
You should. Let me talk about ballot in Canada and Hawaii.
Boy, that's funny. all right, what else is coming out this week? The Odd Life of Timothy Green. I did not see this because it looked like treacly Disney crap. It looked like treacly Disney crap.
Well, that answers my question because I was going to say I don't remember talking about this, but we probably didn't then because I didn't see it either. So.
This movie, if it could have easily been a horror film, but the thing that I thought was interesting about it, I said, you know, if they would have made the movie and made it a drama and a little black kid would have came out the ground, they'd be running for the hills. But, you know, it's a little white boy with stems coming out his legs, so it was cool. So I remember having this conversation with Nell Minow, and she fell out laughing. She's like, Tim, you are a psychopath.
I said that, too, on this show, that it would have been more interesting if they had made it a black kid who came up out of the ground. And it was still his same old white parents, though, but it was a black kid who came out. That would have been interesting. I would have paid to see that movie, but...
you guys are making me think of, I don't know if it's Delirious or Raw, but Eddie Murphy, when he's talking about how if the Poltergeist family wasn't white, if they were black, it would be a whole different movie. Yeah, do y'all remember that bit?
Yeah, I saw that scenario play out in a haunted house just last week, and it makes for a bad movie. All right. But anyway, oops, I wasn't supposed to talk about that movie yet. Anyway, another thing coming out next week is Hope Springs. This is the movie with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones and Steve Carell. And Steve Carell shouldn't have even been in this movie. This one was really disappointing to me. And I think we talked about this on Around Town. I hate her, man.
If you were 10 or 15 years older, you would have loved this movie.
But I'm not. And I don't think anybody who's that old would really care about this movie either because it doesn't really deal with anything. It doesn't deal with older issues. What it does is every time it has a situation that actually needs to be dealt with, it retreats into sitcom humor. So it doesn't really deal with anything either.
Well, that's ironic considering that I saw it at an AARP screening and all of the AARP members loved the movie. Now, again, I'm with you because I'm not AARP, but, you know, it works for them. Or maybe it was they were watching the free movie, so I don't know.
I think it's because they were watching a free movie. But you also had to figure out that they probably haven't seen but so many movies. Like, they probably only saw The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and Hope Springs all year. They probably didn't see anything else. They're sitting around waiting for Quartet to come out next month. I mean, they're just not they're not going to see that many movies.
Oh, man. If we had an audience over 16, we would not have
it. I'm so glad it's Travis. Travis is a senior citizen, viewer.
Yeah, our demographic for the 80 to 85 crowd is already paltry, so I don't really care if we lose one in the process. Also coming out this week is Silent Night. This is the remake of Silent Night, Deadly Night, with the runaway Santa Claus who's killing everybody in town. I really want to see this.
Yeah, me too, especially after the talk we had about last week.
Yeah. I want to see this. Tim, did you see the original Silent Night, Deadly Night?
That would be a no.
I didn't think so.
So that was Travis. Yeah, that was a good one. Okay, fine. We going there tonight. Okay, cool. Go ahead.
You want us coming out on Blu-ray this week, John?
Yes, I do. I think I know you're about to say Ninja Scroll.
Ninja Scroll. Yep, Ninja Scroll. Probably, if there's a gateway movie to anime, to subtitled anime for people, Ninja Scroll was it. It's like Ninja Scroll and Ghost in the Shell are the two movies that do it for people, that really just sort of indoctrinate you into the world of anime. And Ninja Scroll was the movie that did it for me. And basically, all it is a ninja who goes around and kills people. I mean, that's really all it is.
Yeah,
there's
not
that much else to it.
I was 11.
And it's pretty amazing.
I was 11 when this movie came out, right? And you know when you're a kid, you're with your buddies, and you know, in summer, and you find one of their dads just Playboys, and you get the R-rated movie for the first time, and like you see the violence for some, like, yeah, you see boobs for some, yeah, and then you see Ninja Scroll, and you're like, what? Like, I thought I was watching a cartoon. I had never seen. I was so shocked by what I saw. It was a great movie, fun to watch, but it's got some really out there stuff, especially back then where not everything was a cartoon like it is now, and there weren't that many adult cartoons out like that. But yeah, Ninja Scroll definitely a gateway anime movie, if nothing else.
But you got to remember, back then, and even now, really, the way the Japanese do their anime, they don't look at animation the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
Pixar had the same sort of mentality that the Japanese do when it comes to animation. A movie is a movie. You make it like any other movie, which means you don't dumb it down. You don't play it for a specific audience. You make it as mature. You make the movie the way the creative people want to make it. And Ninja Scroll is one of those movies that's like that. Which is why you haven't really seen much in the way of sequels since that movie came out either, because nobody wants to touch it. But yeah, the guys who made Ninja Scroll really kind of broke the mold when it comes to making swords and ninja style animation. With that one, is just fantastic.
It blows your mind. And speaking of ninjas, Teenage Ninja Turtles comes out on Blu-ray. I'm not talking about TMNT. I'm talking about the original, 1990? Cowabunga Dude, Ninja Turtles. Not Ninja Rap, guys. I'm sorry, Vanilla Ice is in part two. This is part one, and it's hitting Blu-ray. $12.99
awesome.
Right now.
Awesome. I'm going to get that. Every time I see Elizabeth Hogue in a movie, I still call her April O'Neil. It doesn't matter what movie it is. I just saw her in something, actually, and I think I was talking to Sandy Chin, and I was like, April O'Neil! And she's like, what? I was like, oops. I wasn't supposed to say that out loud.
Played Casey Jones in that. Is it Chris Maloney? There's Chris Maloney and another guy, and they look damn same. I can never tell.
It's not Chris Maloney. It's the other guy.
Oh.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Also coming out is Butter. This is the movie with Jennifer Garner, Ty Burrell, Hugh Jackman. The Butter sculpting comedy that I had on my Windows Media Player and still couldn't bring myself to watch it. I just couldn't. Couldn't get me in there.
Just to clarify, just so anybody thinks you misspoke or there was something on the air, he did say butter sculpting comedy. That is what
it
this
is. Butter sculpting comedy. Yep. With a political allegory in the center of it as well. So enjoy that. VHS comes out on Blu-ray this week. This is the anthology horror that was just out on demand like 2 weeks ago. It is out on Blu-ray now. I did not see it. Tim Gordon's favorite movie of the year, Thunderstruck, is out on Blu-ray and DVD. This is the movie with Kevin Durant and Brandon T. Jackson. I think Tim flew across the country to talk to Kevin Durant about this movie, too. Which shows you just
not,
how much,
man.
Shows you
we
just
were
how much
all
you
invited
like
to fly across the country, but none of us went, thank God. You talking about the simple movie where a little geeky kid touches the ball the same time that Kevin Durant touches it and gets his skills and.
Yeah.
I like the movie a lot better when it was called Like Mike with Lil Bow Wow.
Yeah, same shit.
No, don't insult Like Mike. Like Mike was better than Thunderstruck.
No, I'm just saying the same gimmick.
Let's see.
I honestly believe that is in the top five of the worst movies of the year, which I have a show coming up in about 4 weeks. That's going to be a great show.
Let's see. Also coming out, I told you this was a heavy week for DVDs. Capitalizing on Les Miserables is Oklahoma, which is coming out on Blu-ray, and this has Hugh Jackman in it. This is Hugh Jackman in a stage performance of Oklahoma. So if you really love Hugh Jackman and you really can't get enough of his voice, Oklahoma's for you. I've had my fill.
It should be noted that if you love Hugh Jackman because of Wolverine, you don't want to see him on stage because it'll probably ruin Wolverine for you. He is very, very happy to be on stage and dancing around. It doesn't look very Wolverine-like, I'll be honest with you.
Remember when he was in, Viva Las Vegas or whatever that
Oh,
crap
God, that
was?
Horrible show that was on one episode?
How happy he was to be in that pilot episode?
He's jazz hands all the way, dude. He's out there giving it his all, and it's just like
Why
kind of like...
Why are y'all crushing the song and dance man who just happens to do action movies?
But no, you know what, Tim, you're on the money. That's what he is, the song and dance man how to do. But we knew him from action movies, and he looks the part. It's not like when Neil Patrick Harris, got into theater. You know, we weren't like, oh, the beloved captain from Starship Troopers is dancing around. You know, but Hugh Jackman looks like an action hero. But he gets up there, puts on his top hat, gets his cane. He's Fred Astaire all day.
Man, you wait until y'all see Val John in a couple of weeks, man. I'm talking about somebody's song and dance, man.
I've seen it and I don't need to see it again. Also coming out on Blu-ray is one of the best foreign language films I've seen in the last decade. That is Tell No One, coming out on Blu-ray. This is a very compelling story. It's about a guy whose wife is murdered by an unknown assailant, and then 8 years later, he discovers information that says she may be alive. It's a taut, really well done foreign thriller. And it's being remade right now. I think Ben Affleck is actually attached to be directing it. But if you have a chance to check out Tell No One, I'd say definitely get that. So it's available right now on Blu-ray.
That is a busy week. I mean, and it's crazy that you can buy all these DVDs at a discount at punchdrunkcritics.com. Click on shop at punchdrunkcritics, the upper right-hand corner. Goes right through Amazon, so you can trust us. We promise.
And how much is that discount again?
Whatever Amazon is offering.
for the Dark Knight trilogy, it's 43%.
Yeah, 43%.
It's pretty good.
Offering wait a minute, stop. I can buy the Dark Knight trilogy on punchdrunkcritics.com shop and get a 43% discount?
That's true, Tim. You can do that right now.
Man, let me go there right now.
Oh man, I'm trying. I only have game show losing sounds on the soundboard. I couldn't find anything for, so that's not going to happen. But yeah, you can buy it right now on Instant Watcher this week. like I said, if you guys haven't gotten a chance to go check out Hugo on Instant Watcher, that is still available. King's Speech hit Instant Watcher as well. Young Adult, the Charlize Theron comedy. Red Dawn, the original. Half-Baked, a movie I love to watch every single time it's on.
Have you watched Half-Baked lately?
I started to watch it like an hour before the show, to be honest with you. I saw it on Netflix.
Are you kidding me? Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie in at least a decade. That was back when Dave Chappelle was funny.
Yeah, I didn't go through the whole movie. I only got about 10 minutes in, so I can't say how it stands up just yet. But
let me know.
Not well.
I was about to say, let me know, because I remember the last time I watched it, I was really tired of it after about 20 minutes.
Well,
the only part that's really still funny is when he started talking about wanting to how does he say it?
Back out of me.
Now, that's funny.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'll be straight up honest. Half the time, if it's older movies like this, I don't know if they actually hold up or if I'm enjoying the nostalgia. So, I'll probably like it, and it probably doesn't hold up very well. But it was funny for what I got into it as. Scream, the Wes Craven 1996 horror movie that changed the face of horror for that decade, is out. Bad Boys 2, Tim Gordon's favorite movie of the 2000s. American Horror Story Season 1 and The Hole are all on Instant Watcher.
The Hole, that's a porn movie, right?
It could be. It's not the one on Netflix, though.
Okay. That's the porn movie by Joe Dante, The Hole.
Oh, yes, right? Yes. It is by Joe Dante, yeah.
It, I know it's by Joe Dante, but it's not a porn.
It's also starring Lindsay Lohan.
It's a porn movie by the guy who made Gremlins.
Yes.
All right.
You do that Gremlin from Gremlins. Going to do something.
All right. Let's get in. Let's jump into a little bit of news here before we wrap up the show. We still got 20 minutes.
Indeed.
There's a lot of crap that went on this week in terms of news, and they all had to deal with. The major stuff that we like to cover,
mm-hmm.
comic books and Star Wars. So let's start with comic books first.
All right.
The big rumor that came out earlier this week had to do with Joseph Gordon-Levitt possibly taking on the role of Batman in the Justice League movie. Now, we all saw the Dark Knight Rises, and mm-hmm. I'm assuming anybody who's listening to this show saw the Dark Knight Rises, so they know how it is.
I didn't see it yet.
Oh, you didn't see it yet? Then hang up. Then we know how it ended with him being revealed to be Robin and basically taking over the job of being Batman. The rumor had it that Gordon-Levitt would basically continue on from that movie, and donning the Batman outfit in Justice League. So he wouldn't be playing Bruce Wayne; he'd be playing, you know, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool. I mean, Warner Brothers has been sort of up in the air about what they're going to do. There's been talk lately from Zack Snyder that Man of Steel is going to connect with Justice League and that they are trying to build their own Marvel-style connected world. And this would certainly lend into that, you know. But, of course, the very next day, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's people came out and said there's no truth to the rumor. But that doesn't mean it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of how these things work. But I want to get your opinion, both of you, actually. Would you want to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt play Batman in a Justice League movie? And you go first, John.
Without thinking about it, I'd say no. I'd say he's too small. But Christian Bale is incredibly small in it.
Keaton!
I know,
Michael
but
Keaton's
I just...
Keaton's that big?
Travis, you know I don't think about stuff when I say it. I just say it. That's my first thought. I think he'd be really cool. He did a lot of he was doing a voice that could be used as a Batman voice during The Dark Knight Rises that I think would fit, and I think he would be good for the role. He'd be good as the Playboy type Bruce Wayne slash Robin, whatever his mm-hmm. alias will be. But my thing with it is I'm interested. I want it to happen just so I can know how they're going to explain how he becomes Batman, because he gets the keys to the cave, but what he doesn't have is the billions of dollars of new equipment that can come in all the time. You know, what if he breaks something?
Well,
can't get a radio check.
He probably would. He probably would have access to all that stuff through.
Well, Bruce Wayne was broke, wasn't he?
Broke? Did you see him at the end of the movie? He did not look broke.
Well, I mean, as broke as rich people get broke, where they always have a Swedish bank account. But I would be interested, and I think he could bring a lot to it. I think he's going to set a higher bar for the actors that play the rest of the heroes. Mm-hmm. But I think he would be the type of actor that I would want to in a Justice League movie because of the dynamic you can obviously tell he would have that would fit how Batman is in the Justice League.
Tim?
When you talk about the Justice League movie, is Christopher Nolan going to have anything to do with this?
No. I talked to him at Thanksgiving, and Uncle Chris said that he'd probably not. Nope.
Well, at that point, man, I don't really think it matters because and Travis, you know how I feel about this, man. I mean, I think Nolan has really created a world or created a tone that's much different from what – or is actually the total polar opposite of what Marvel has done, and I think it can be successful. They tried to bring that tone to Superman. As it relates to the Justice League, I'm not being funny, but you need to have somebody in it who is behind the scenes. It's not really about the actor, because we all know Christian Bale didn't really overly impress anybody in three films as Batman, because it wasn't about him. It was about, you know, the galaxy of villains that he had to fight from movie to movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be perfectly honest, I mean, it depends for me largely on who's choreographing the action, you know, writing the script, directing, you know, putting everything into motion, more so than it is about who's wearing the cape and the cowl.
For me, the way I look at this thing, Warner Brothers is in a really prime position here. Now, maybe a year ago, I would have said they've really fucked everything up. And it's because they had fucked everything up a year ago. They had plans on starting this thing a while back. But Green Lantern proved to be such a disaster that they basically had to start from square one. And if Man of Steel fails, they'll be starting from square one again. But all things being equal, if Man of Steel works out and they get a solid footing for Justice League, they have the most recognizable heroes in all of the world. More than X-Men, more than Iron Man, more than Captain America. Nobody gives a shit about those characters, really, before those movies came out. But everybody knows Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Green Lantern, The Flash. Everybody knows them. If they get this thing on the right footing, then they're gonna dominate Marvel. And I'm just going to say that straight up. They will dominate Marvel.
You're 100% on target there. I mean, everybody, it's hard for us to remember now, I guess, but Iron Man was a third-rate comic hero. I mean, I think he always had one of the best storylines, but
was old Shellhead is what they called him in the comics. They called him Old Shellhead. He was not a major character.
He was not the rock star that he is now.
Old Shellhead?
Called him Shellhead. They still call him that on occasion. But that's all he was. He was not the character he is now. He was just a guy in a suit. and basically they changed him around. Warren Ellis came around, and you know, Joe Quesada, and they turned him into the futurist Tony Stark, and that's what he is now. Mm-hmm. And it was smart. It was smart that they did it. But what Warner Brothers needs to do, if they're going to make these movies, they have to try and have the same level of talent as Marvel has. Marvel really raised the bar in hiring all A-list people to be in the Avengers. And if they're going to make a movie like Justice League, as much as I like Armie Hammer, and I thought the rumor about him coming back as Batman like he was supposed to 5 years ago with the George Miller Justice League movie, as much as I like him, he's not an A-list star. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is an A-list star. You have to have actors like Joseph Gordon-Levitt if you're going to make this movie on par with the Avengers. So I would like to see that rumor happen. Right now it's unclear if it will or not, but we'll see.
Okay. Let me jump in for a second and ask you a question.
Yeah.
Henry Cavill as Superman.
Right.
How does that stack up with, you know, what Marvel has done and what Warner Brothers has done prior to this film?
Henry Cavill at this point is like what Chris Hemsworth was before they hired him for Thor.
Mm.
It's essentially the same thing. They're going to try to build stars. They're going to try to. You got to remember, Man of Steel was in development long before this Justice League was in development. So at the time they hired him, they were looking to build a star, and they're going to hope to try and do that with Man of Steel and after Man of Steel. So if it all works out to plan, he'll be at the same level as Chris Hemsworth was by the time Justice League rolls around in 2015. So that's the hope. That's the hope. So we'll see what happens from there.
That's a tough role. I mean, it's kind of scary to take that role.
It really is. That's a tough role.
Nobody wants it, man, because of the Superman curse.
You fuck it up, you'll be remembered forever. I mean, as much as Brandon Routh, I don't think he's a horrible actor, he's always going to be remembered as the guy who really sucked ass as Superman.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what else he does or what else he's done. He's always going to be that guy. So, you know, it's a tough gig.
Yep.
Nobody puts together for profanity like Travis Hobson, man. I'm like, what?
Sticking with the world of superheroes, we're jumping to the X-Men world now. Talking about X-Men Days of Future Past. This is the sequel to X-Men First Class. And the two stories that came out this week in regards to those are that Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen are definitely coming back as Charles Xavier and Magneto. But the story that came after that, maybe a day later, was that Hugh Jackman is in talks to return as Wolverine. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Days of Future Past is a story that's set in both the present and the future. And basically it deals with a future where mutants are hunted down because of something that happened in the present. The X-Men are incapable of protecting a senator from being assassinated by Mystique. So what happens is the government cracks down on mutants and begins putting them into internment camps. So this is a story that's going to be in both the present and the future. And so that's why you have these older characters returning for this movie. But I look at it as a possible way of, well, first of all, what it does is it shows you that all of the X-Men movies are now connected. That goes all the way back from the X-Men to X-Men The Last Stand. All these X-Men movies are now connected. This pretty much proves that. But it's also a way for them to sort of do a soft reboot of the X-Men franchise, sort of in the way that J.J. Abrams did with Star Trek. I can see that happening. Now, I'm not saying that's what will happen, but I see the groundwork for it. It's really cool either way.
I haven't read the storyline in the comics. What are we looking at? Because what I was thinking when you were explaining it the first time was that it would open with like Patrick Stewart type deal, and then it would be flashback the whole movie, and then right back to the future. Or are we talking like a 50-50 split? Or are we going back and forth the whole time?
Well, I mean, the comic story takes place mostly in the present, but I mean they're going to do a lot of major tweaking for this. You know, they have to, because not all the characters are in it. That are in the movie or they're in the comic, you know, and vice versa. So they're going to do a lot of – we don't know how they're going to finally break this thing down, but that's the gist of that storyline is what I described. So we'll see.
Cool.
But it's cool that those three people are coming back with these movies. I mean, they appeared in – I mean, Wolverine was in X-Men First Class in that really cool cameo, remember?
Yeah. Yeah,
go fuck yourselves.
Yeah,
I mean, so it's cool that he's coming back again, and I think this also pretty much lends credence to the earlier rumor that Jean Grey was going to be in the Wolverine. There was a rumor about that. Famke Janssen was supposedly spotted on set as Jean Grey. So I think this lends credence to that they're setting something up here. They're setting up an X-Men 4 is basically what it sounds like they're doing as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, I think the audience reaction of that Wolverine cameo pretty much guaranteed that he was going to be some part in everything. They were going to try their hardest to do that.
Yeah. So Jean Valjean will be popping his claws a couple more times as Wolverine. if he had popped his claws in Les Miserables, it would have been a better movie. But if I was,
Man, you drop all kinds of review spoilers in this show.
Not really. I just said it'd be a better movie. Didn't say it'd be a good movie. All right, let's jump into Star Wars a little bit. All right, you know me and you, we both have been big, you know, big fans of Colin Trevorrow. We really wanted him to be the guy to direct Star Wars Episode 7. We thought it was going to be him.
Mm-hmm.
Last week we talked about the fact that he had said it wasn't going to be him, and we still kind of were like, it'll probably still be him. No, it's not going to be him. Colin Trevorrow came out, and we learned that him and his Safety Not Guaranteed writer, Derek Connolly, are going to be doing a remake of Flight of the Navigator.
That's the movie he was talking
about? Yes. That was the movie he was talking about. It was Flight of the Navigator.
I mean, I love that movie, but I wouldn't say...
No, me too.
I wouldn't think it's that kind of level where it really makes sense what he was saying.
I don't know. I guess in a way it does. I mean, if you were of a certain age and you liked Flight of the Navigator, you might be like, really? They're gonna remake that movie, one of my favorite movies from my childhood, and they're going to do that now?
Mm-hmm.
I guess you'd be a little bit upset by it, but I'm not. I mean, I liked it, but it's not iconic or anything. So
yeah.
I'm like, I think it sounds cool. I mean, I'm disappointed he's not doing Star Wars, but this sounds cool.
Yeah, and the new names, I don't know if they've already been refuted. I haven't checked past that. But, like, David Fincher being up for it?
Yeah, that was the next on the thing. Was David Fincher and Jon Favreau were the next two names mentioned. David Fincher was mentioned as a possibility to direct it, basically because he has a past with Kathleen Kennedy, and he worked at Lucasfilm briefly. But apparently he's in the running. I don't buy that for a second. But the other part of that story was Jon Favreau, who's really apparently lobbying for the job.
Mm-hmm.
If you read what he said, like right after the deal went down, he sounded like somebody who wanted that fucking job. And I think I wrote that too. It's like he really sounds like he wants this job. And apparently that's what he's doing. He's lobbying hard for it. I really don't want to see Jon Favreau directing Star Wars because I think he's from a Disney perspective, I can understand it because he's a franchise guy. You know, he did two Iron Man movies that were big hits, but he's also a guy with a director who doesn't have a specific style, so that he can just make it look like a Star Wars movie. Whereas somebody like David Fincher would hate the creative constraints.
I'm with you 100% on that. I think those two names are so far the polar opposites, and you would need something in the middle. Because Jon Favreau, as good as the Iron Man movies were, they're pure popcorn entertainment. They don't have the depth that a successful Star Wars new trilogy needs to have.
So is Cowboys and Aliens. I mean, he makes a certain kind of...
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Can I jump in?
Yes.
I just heard John say something. What's a successful Star Wars film? Because the last three were not successful. So unless you're talking about a Star Wars movie from the mid to early 80s, what's the last successful Star Wars movie?
Not
commercially.
Successful.
I'm talking about artistically.
Artistically, of course. I mean, Tim, I know we haven't initiated you as a full Star Wars nerd yet, but whenever we refer to the Star Wars movies, it's always the original trilogy. It's never the prequels.
I'm sorry.
These are things you got to know, Tim. They're on the test.
So virtue that the original trilogy were the last artistic ones that were good, you know, why not somebody like a Jon Favreau who can come in, or as you talked about, a David Fincher?
Well, because David Fincher, I think, would make it too cerebral, and Jon Favreau wouldn't make it cerebral enough. I mean, the Star Wars movies are amazing for one reason, and that's they can be enjoyed both by people that want to look at them for the immense depth they have, or just watch them on the surface because it looks cool. That's the problem that was with the prequel trilogy, is they put all the cool stuff in it, but they forgot all the depth, all the things that people were really getting engrossed in, the things that made it the property it is. And to find that level, you need to have somebody that kind of understands all parts, and I don't see either one of those guys hitting all those nails. But I'm going to be super critical of anybody that takes the job.
Well, ultimately, David Fincher's not going to – he wouldn't have the opportunity to make it too stylized. He just couldn't because it's a Disney property, and they're not going to want that sort of thing. That's why somebody like Favreau will be a perfect fit, because he'll do whatever they want him to do. And he, like I said, he doesn't have a fingerprint as a filmmaker. He's just a guy who does whatever's called for. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Favreau got it, but I really hope not.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised.
What about Christopher Nolan?
Yeah, right. No. It might be cool, but he would never. First of all, I don't think he would do it, and second of all, I'm not so sure. Well, Disney would hire him, but I don't think he'd be a good fit.
That was a joke.
I know it was. The last thing on Star Wars, it seems like Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote Empire Strikes Back, and Simon Kinberg, who wrote a bunch of the X-Men movies, it sounds like they may not be writing episodes 8 and 9 like we thought they were. They may be doing Star Wars spinoffs instead. Which, I mean, that's just a rumor right now, but that's what they're saying. It could be Star Wars spinoffs, which probably won't surprise anybody because it's Disney, and they're going to shit out spinoffs left and right for the next forever.
Yeah, so. You know, I didn't realize you've been saying that, and I was with you. I mean, because Disney's going to produce stuff, but I didn't realize the level of which they do that until I was watching my niece and nephew, and you know, they got to Disney. I never watched Disney channels. You know, because I'll watch the DVDs if I want to watch them. I didn't realize that every one of their major movies, like there's a Little Mermaid 4, there's like every one of these movies has all these sequels, but even past that, there's a Cars TV show, there's ridiculous numbers.
Everywhere.
Every property is proliferated across the Disney medium everywhere. And when I saw that, I was like, that's what Travis is talking about. Wow.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. There's stuff everywhere, and that's what they're going to do with Star Wars. I mean, we already know they plan on making a Star Wars movie every other year, like every 2 years. But in between that time, there's going to be a ton of stuff, and I don't know if there may be. This is just something that popped in my head. There was always that live action TV series that they were talking about that basically got scrapped. I wouldn't be surprised if they take some of those scripts from that and use them to craft some of these spinoffs they're talking about.
Because it seemed like, I mean, you can never really get a straight answer from Lucasfilm when they were around, but it really seemed like that show was almost in the stages of starting to cast and starting to, you know, shoot a pilot or something like that. So they had plenty of stuff written. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's stuff out there. But that's basically all I had news-wise. We got a bunch of trailers that are available on the site right now that are worth checking out. A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. This is the second film from Roman Coppola. Stars Charlie Sheen, basically playing Charlie Sheen. Texas Chainsaw 3D. Black Rock, which is a horror movie I saw back at Sundance. The very first movie I saw at Sundance, actually. Really shitty trailer, though. It's kind of disappointing. Freeloaders from John's favorites over at Broken Lizard. And the final trailer for Django Unchained, which we now know will be 2 hours, 45 minutes, and 11 seconds long. So, pack a lunch.
So you don't want me to give you a spoiler on this one, because I've heard some stuff already.
Nope.
All right. Okay.
Nope.
Never mind. I'm not gonna say it. Go ahead.
Oh man, we've missed you, Tim. We've missed you on air here. Samuel Jackson is in Captain America: The Winter Soldier. You're not going to see him in Iron Man 3. I thought that was pretty cool. And the only other thing I really wanted to bring up that we didn't cover already was the Pacific Rim stuff. It just looks it looks so cool. I'm on board 100%.
Yeah, the viral website went up this week, and they just dumped a ton of stuff that day, and I was pissed off because I had been gone for like 10 hours. So I came home and it was like 10 different Pacific Rim things that were out. An amazing first look footage from the film with the monster destroying San Francisco, and 4 or 5 blueprints of the Jaegers, which are the giant robots that are used to fight the monsters. They all look really cool. I'm on board with this movie too, so I'm right there with you.
Oh man, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah, it is.
And we've covered it. It was pretty much comic book news I had. So yeah, we're all good then.
Yeah, I think we're just about done, and we're past our time. So luckily I extended it. But anyway, for next week's show looks really, really crappy. in terms of reviews.
In terms of reviews,
the content is crappy. Playing for Keeps, which is the Gerard Butler really dreadful looking romantic comedy where he plays an ex soccer player. That looks terrible. And Deadfall, which is the thriller that you remember I missed at Virginia Film Festival, with Charlie Hunnam and Olivia Wilde, the overexposed Olivia Wilde, and Eric Bana and Kate Mara. So great cast. Whether the movie's good or not, we'll find out next week. In a couple weeks we're also going to start our Best of the Year show, which we will definitely have to have Tim Gordon on, and I'm trying to get our good friend Nell Minow to be a part of that as well. I know she was here for our 6 month favorites, but I want to get her here for the year end show as well. So we definitely need to do that as well. Start planning.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't know why. I was about to say the exact same thing you just said. I don't know why I started doing that. So join us next week, and make sure to check the site out every single day. Is our current giveaway still going on? I don't want to tell the people if they haven't heard about it and get excited and it's already closed.
For The Hobbit?
Yes.
The Hobbit is still going on for another 2 or 3 days. So if you have not signed up for that one yet, this now is the time to do it. We got a lot of people who've already entered for the passes to see that a little bit early, so I would do that soon.
Yes, I'd also like to point out that these giveaways are usually on a random picking basis. And on a totally unrelated note, there's a donate button on the punch chart. You guys are looking for it. I'm just saying. No, I'm kidding. Don't do that. I shouldn't have done that. But seriously, it's there. So we'll check you guys out next week. Tim, throw your plug out, man.
Hey, man, I'm hanging. What was you saying?
I was saying throw your plug out. Where can we
find you? I'm going to be on the show this Thursday previewing the award season, and then we will also be talking about Travis Hobson, who's supposed to be co-hosting the WAFTA award announcement a week from Monday.
Oh, Lord.
A week from tomorrow. How's that?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Awesome.
And you can find that right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Breaking news. What can I say? Breaking news.
Breaking news.
Always look forward
announcements
to it.
Are made. That's how we do things. We're exclusives. We're here. That's what we do. And you can find Tim every Thursday right on blogtalkradio.com/filmgordon. So make sure to check that out. We are the Punch Drunk Critics. You can find us every single day at punchdrunkcritics.com. Like I've mentioned only, I think, once. So you can shop at Punch Drunk Critics by clicking the link in the upper right-hand corner. We're powered by Amazon, so it's discount to you and no other trouble. It helps us out a little bit. On Facebook, we are Punch Drunk Critics. Twitter at PunchDrunkJohn and at PunchyCritic. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or just want to talk, you can email us at PunchDrunkCritics@yahoo.com or gmail.com.
If you just want to talk. If you're that bored that you just want to random talk to us, then we actually do need to talk. Because we need to, but it won't be what you want to talk about. Anyway, I think we're out of here. Tim, thank you for joining us, man.
Hey, man, anytime I can be with my two favorites.
Later.
All right, guys.
Bye.
See you next week.
Bye.
We came, we saw, we kicked his ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so, that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.